So the problem here is the word vayeshev is difficult. Because concerning Yitzchok, it says megurei aviv. So the question is, why does it say by Yitzchok megurei, that he lived there as a ger, and by Yaakov it says vayeshev? So Rashi here is in Posuk Bet, towards the end. Ve'oid nidrash, bo vayeshev. Why does it say by Yaakov vayeshev? Because bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalvo. Yaakov wanted to settle b'shalvo, shalvo with calmness. Kofatz olov rugzoi shel Yosef. So the anger, which means the problem stemming from Joseph, started. Tzadikim mevakshim leisha b'shalvo, because righteous men want to live a calm life. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so God says, lo dayon la tzadikim ma shemesukon lohem lo lo mabo. Isn't it sufficient what they'll get in the world to come? Elo shemevakshim leisha b'shalvo b'olo mazeh. They have to sit calmly in this world. It's sufficient what they'll get in the next world. So this is why Vayeshev Yaakov. Yaakov wanted to be in Olam Habo, says Rashi. So came God and reminded him that he's not in Olam Habo yet. He's in Olam Hazeh. And this is why Joseph's problem started. Now, obviously, Chazal, that Rashi's quoting, are basing the drash on the word Vayeshev. Right? Meaning, they realize that really it should say Vayogor Yaakov, right? In order for the pasuk to be consistent, it should say Vayogor Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Ovim, right? In order to, that the verb Lagur should be the one used. So the rabbi saw somehow the Torah uses the word Vayeshev. Vayeshev is like a Toshav as opposed to a Ger, right? A Toshav is somebody who has in mind to settle forever. A ger is someone who has an awareness of the temporariness of the situation. Okay? So Yaakov wanted that this should be it. In what sense? I mean, what is it that Yaakov thought? So, there is no question that Yaakov thought that after going through all his troubles with Lavan and Esau, he has gone through the exile, which means they had an awareness, a knowledge of the prophecy to Abraham. They knew that there is a process of golus, of purification, that has to precede the eventual settling down in the land of Israel. Only then can we settle down with finality in the land of Israel. He thought, Yaakov thought, that the golus is over. Now, this is a very important theme concerning the whole parsha of the brothers and Yosef himself, as we are going to see later on. But this is an important piece of information that the rabbis are trying to tell us. Because Yaakov wanted that this should be it. Right? The final step towards Israel. We are here to stay forever. Exile is over forever and ever.
Yeah. Didn't expect the trouble with Yosef?
Not at all.
What about Elihu Elishaphat?
Yeah. Retrospect, we know that that's what it means, right? But we don't know what he meant at the time, right? I mean, it could be very well that he thought the problem with Yosef, right, is Esau. Don't forget that he didn't know how each one of the troubles is going to come out, right? You know that when he decided to leave Lavan, when Yosef was born. Why? Because he knows that only Yosef is capable of overcoming Esau. Only Yosef is capable of overcoming Esau. So maybe he thought that the Yosef trouble is the meeting of Esau. I mean, we don't know. We have no idea. Meaning, in retrospect, we know what the Yud is, that it's Yosef according to the Gro. But we don't know what Yaakov thought at the time. There is another problem besides the youth. A much greater problem is the 400 years. How does Yaakov figure the 400 years? Right? Part of the prophecy is exile for 400 years and then redemption. How does he figure the exile? So one of the commentaries says simple. You see, he figured that if you add up the exiles of each one of the Jews in the world, meaning his life, right? Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, if you add them all up, more or less, it's pretty close to 400, by the way. If you figure out the ages of the children, plus the age of Jacob, it comes out to about 400 years. So, it comes up, according to one of the commentaries that figured, oh, exile is over. Each one of us, the Jews, if we add up all our exiles by Laban together, we were in exile for 400 years. Exile is over. We are now redeemed forever. This is a very important piece of information in order to understand later on the rest of the parsha. But this is what the Torah is trying to tell you. Of course, the rabbis say, but of course he was wrong. Because you can't find Olam Habo in Olam Hazeh. It means the timing is wrong. Right? That's what the rabbis are telling you. Jacob was wrong. Vayeshev, it wasn't the time for Vayeshev. Okay? Now, Eile Toldos Yaakov, Yosef ben Shva Yisrei Shano, Hoyor Roi Yesechov Batsoim Vunares Bnei Bilovez Bnei Zilpone Sheyovim, and Vayove Yosef Es Gibosom Ro'o El Avihem. And he brought slander of the brothers to the father. Okay? Yeah. Brings slander. Now, do you know what is the normal way of the in the Tanakh to slander someone? Is motzi dibo. There's no motzi dibo, lo hotzi diba, motzi diba. Says the Rabbeinu Bechaye, right here. It says, why does it say here Vayove Yosef? It should have said Vayotzi Yosef as Dibo Somro. He says, because when it says Motzi Dibo, it means when I make up a story and it's wrong, it's a lie. When I say Vayove as Dibo Som, it means that I'm bringing a fact. Which means that whatever Yosef said was true. What did Yosef say concerning his brothers?
They're going to bow down to him.
What?
That they're going to bow down to him.
No, that's long before this. What did he say? What was the slander? Says Rashi here, Rashi as the Bosom Ro'o, says Rashi, Kol Ro'o she'oyoroye be'echo, bnei Leo, whatever he saw that the sons of Leo used to do, hoyo magid le'ovi, because Rashi's opinion is, we won't go into it, that really the real enemies of Joseph were only Bnei Leo, the sons of Leo. The sons of Bilo and Zilpo were his friends, according to Rashi. According to the Ramban, he said that's impossible, because if that would be true, then the majority would be for Joseph. If you add up the sons of Bilo and Zilpo and Reuven, who wasn't against Joseph, and Yehuda, who wasn't against Joseph, you have a majority for Joseph. So Ramban argues, well, it doesn't matter. We won't go into the problem itself, but the fact is that against someone, he said, he slandered. What did he say against them? One, Shehoyu Oichlin Eivar Minachai, that he saw his brothers tearing off pieces of a live animal. Here. Two, Umezalzelim Bivnei Hashfochos, they made fun of the children of the maids. Right? How? Likroishon Avodim, they say, oh, those servants. And number three, Vechashudim al Harayos, he suspected them of transgressing the law of Harayos, right? Sexual transgressions. First of all, it's hard to accept such a tradition, because we are talking about tzaddikim, we're not talking about evil people here, we are talking about great people. I mean, how does it fit the image that we have concerning the brothers of Joseph? that what they were tearing off pieces of the animal. It's impossible. This is one of the seven commandments of Bnei Noach. You're not allowed to tear off a piece of a live animal. So they will go and do it. It's just impossible. That they arise, that transgress sexual transgressions. I mean, that's prohibited even for a Gentile, sexual transgressions. And they insulted the Bnei Ashvochit by calling them Avodim. Just doesn't fit. So what are you going to say? No, they didn't do it. And Yosef made up the stories. I just told the Rabbeinu Bechaya that Vayoveh Yosef means that it happened. And to complicate the matter, so Rashi goes on to say that he was punished for all those who bishloishtom loko, says Rashi. And he was punished for the three averas that he did. Alever minachai, for saying that they tear off pieces of a live animal. Mido keneged mido, he was punished measure for measure. Vaishchatu sirizim, when they sold him, they made up the story that what he was torn by an animal. And that is the punishment measure for his slander. Valdibo shesipra alem shekor lachiem avodim, and that what he slandered them by saying that they call the children of the maid slaves, himself became a slave. Valharayos, and that they committed sexual transgressions, he himself was tempted with a sexual transgression that got him into terrible trouble. What was it? The wife of Potiphar. So everything was measure for measure. So why was he punished? Because he made it up. But we're just saying that he didn't make it up. So what's really going on? What's really happening over here? Now, before we go into the nature of the dreams, right? There are two dreams here that Yosef says over to the brothers. One concerning bundles of grain, and one concerning stars and the sun and the moon. But the recurrent theme is what? In both dreams. He is the king and everybody else is subservient to them. In other words, the message of Yosef to the brothers is, you are still subservient. By their rejecting his dream, what are they saying? We are not subservient anymore. We are free. True? Free of what? There is no question about it. Says the Baal Mishneh LeMelech. You know, you have a Pirush on the Rambam Mishneh LeMelech. This man, the Mishneh LeMelech, wrote a Pirush. He wrote a commentary on the Torah called Proshas Drochim. So he says that the whole argument between Yosef and his brothers was concerning the interpretation of the prophecy to Abraham. What was the prophecy that God gave to Abraham? Your children will be exiled. Yes? And after the exile, you'll come up with riches, which means your children have to go through a process of purification before they are ready to settle down. The question is that process of purification ended or not? What did I tell you Vayeshev Yaakov meant? That Yaakov thought that exile is over. The purification process is over. Now, what halachic consequence is there whether the exile is over or exile is not over? Now, let me give you a halachic difference of whether exile is over or not. Remember, exile means the process of purification for the Jew to become a full Jew. Yes? Now, if we are in the middle of the exile, then we are not fully Jewish. We are in the process of being Jewish. Now, we Jews, right? Are we just Gentiles plus, or are we qualitatively different? I'll prove it to you. You hear the question? Is a Jew a Gentile plus, on top of being a Gentile, he's also a Jew? Right? Or by being Jewish, you can't be called a Gentile anymore. What difference does it make? I'll give you a case where it makes a difference. Gentiles have a law that they are not allowed to eat an animal, right? That if they tear off a piece of a live animal. We Jews have a special law that for us an animal becomes kosher by slaughtering the animal in a kosher way. Yes? Theoretically, you can slaughter an animal and the animal is technically alive. It still walks around after you slaughtered it. I've seen it myself. You slaughter an animal, the animal gets up, walks around for a few seconds. What is the law of the animal in those few seconds, or sometimes it can be a few minutes? Is the animal halachically dead, or is it halachically alive? You know what the law is? Depends whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. If you're a Gentile, then the fact that you slaughtered it means nothing. The animal is 100% alive. If you were to tear off a piece of this animal when it's still alive and eat it, you would be transgressing the law of Eiver Min HaChai. But if you are Jewish, yes, then you have done your obligation. You cease to be a Gentile. Gentile laws don't apply to you anymore. Therefore, can you tear off a piece of that animal and eat it? Yes, you can. Do you hear this? You slaughter an animal, the animal is still alive, but as far as you are concerned, the animal is already kosher, therefore you can tear off a piece and eat it. Okay? Now, why is that? Because we are not Gentiles anymore. We are Jewish. Right? The question is, what was Abraham? What was Isaac? What was Jacob? Were they Jews? Or were they Gentiles plus? Good question, right? Makes sense, the question. The answer is that they were Gentiles plus because they haven't gone through the process of purification. Right? In order for the Jewish people to change completely, they have to go through exile. Now, if the brothers of Joseph believe that the process of purification is over, animal, and they, right after they shech, they cut up the animal and they eat it. If they see themselves as free, redeemed, can they eat this animal? How does Joseph see it? Joseph is the one that's telling them what? Exile is not over. You still have to go through a process of subservience. This is the recurring theme in the dreams. Therefore, what do we see? That Joseph believes that exile is not over. Therefore, you are still Gentiles plus. So can they eat from that animal? So according to Joseph's point of view, what are the brothers eating? Eiver min hachai. Okay? Clear? Point number two. The status, the halachic status of slavery, right? Does it exist among Gentiles? Listen carefully to the question. By Jews, there is a halachic status of slavery. A slave to a Jew, I'm not saying a Jewish slave, a slave to a Jew is a semi-Jew. For instance, does he have to be circumcised? Of course. Does he have to keep Shabbos? Of course he has to keep Shabbos. He has to keep all negative commandments of the Torah. Is he allowed to eat non-kosher food? Of course not. Tefillin, he doesn't have to put on. Tzitzis, he doesn't have to put on. But all the negative commandments he has to keep, is he allowed to eat chometz on Passover? Of course not. Because he is an eved to a Jew. The moment he goes free, either by the master sending him free, or by accident, the master broke his foot or whatever, what happens? He goes free into what? He becomes a Jew. He doesn't revert to gentility. He's not a Gentile. He becomes a Jew. Why? Because there is a status of Eved. Before there were Jews in the world, was there a halachic status of Avdus? Or among Gentiles, is there a halachic differentiation? This Gentile is a Gentile, and this, the servant to a Gentile, is a servant to a Gentile. Is there such a halachic differentiation in Torah? It doesn't exist. Do you follow what I'm saying? So when they are saying, the brothers are saying, hey, wait a second, the sons of the maids are not 100% Jewish. We must do something to change their status. They are avodim because their mothers are maids. Why are they saying that? Because they believe that they are in the status of being fully Jewish. What about according to Yosef? That status doesn't exist. So when Rashi says that they call the sons of the maids avodim, it's all they are saying is that we must do something to make them fully Jewish, because halachically they are not fully Jewish yet. But that's only because they believe that we reached the point of full Jewishness. The exile is over. Joseph didn't see it this way. Do you hear how the second point fits in? Of course, that exile is not even over. What are we talking about? Okay. Point number three. Halachically today, a brother and a sister, a Gentile brother and sister, convert to Judaism. What is the law when they become Jewish? Are they allowed to marry each other? Yes, they are. They shouldn't, because it doesn't look right. But halachically, they are allowed to marry each other. Another case. Husband and a wife, Gentile, they both convert to Judaism. Do they have to get remarried? Of course they have to get remarried. They have to marry in a Jewish way, because their Gentile marriage has no value once they become Jewish. Now, according to this, let's say one of the brothers of Joseph would decide that he likes a certain woman. Does he have to bother with divorces or anything like that? Remember, conversion in those days was becoming a part of the family of Jacob. How did people convert in those days? How did Rachel convert? Right? What was conversion in those days? Do you know what conversion was in those days? What? Believing one God, just joining the family. Joining the family of Abraham. That was conversion. Right? So as long as they converted, there was no problem with their previous status. How did Joseph see it? Was the previous status important, relevant, according to Joseph? Of course they are not Jewish yet. They are Gentiles plus they still have to keep the laws of the Gentile. So how does he see what they are capable of doing? As arayos, how do they see it? As 100% permitted. Do you follow me? Which means that the three points that Yosef sees in the brothers all follow the same idea. What are we? Are we Gentiles plus, or are we qualitatively different? Are we Jewish? Or, in different words, is exile over or is exile not over? According to the brothers, exile is over. There is no need for subservience anymore. According to Yosef, we must go through the process of subservience. Okay? This is the nature of the argument between Yosef and the brothers. That's why I told you in the beginning. Yaakov's idea that exile is over is extremely relevant.
How come?
There's the only loose end in this whole thing. Why does it get punished? I mentioned that, but, you know, if I tell you I suspect you of something, what do I mean by that? That you are capable of doing it, you have the possibility of doing it, but I never actually saw you doing it. Right? That's what suspicion means. What does it mean? Yosef said, according to what they believe, they're capable of committing incest. Of course. Following their ideology to the extreme, they will commit incest. That's called suspicion. You understand? Not that he actually saw them doing it. He suspected them. What do I mean he suspected them? He said, do you know what their ideology can lead to? To incest. That's called suspicion. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah. That this opinion that says that each one of the Shvotim married their sister, or there is another opinion that even disagrees with it, but agrees that Shimon married his sister, that Shimon married Dinah, right? So, according to them, they were allowed to, not because they were like Gerim, because they were Gershon and Kodesh and all that, because there is a special heter, there is a special, according to this Mande Omar, they were allowed to marry sisters the same way that the sons of Adam were allowed to marry sisters. Meaning,
no one else it, for be,
exactly, because in their world, right, in other words, for the same reason that Cain was allowed to marry his sister, because in his world those were the only people around, right? Like we spoke about it, by the daughters of a Lot, that when there is no one else around, it's permitted in order to build the world. They considered no one else around. But so that is not because of the heter of Gershon Isgar. Now, how do we answer the punishment for Yosef? So now this is something that we see throughout the Torah. The Torah, God punishes not only when you do something wrong, but even when you do something right. But the way you did it is not 100% right, but 99% right. For that 1% of wrongness, you will be punished. Where do we find it? One example, we heard it a few weeks ago.
Yaakov and Esau.
Yaakov is punished, says the Gemara. Why? Because he stole the blessings? No, that was 100% okay. Because Esau cried. So therefore. So, in one of the commentaries says, yes, because when Esau cried, probably when Yaakov found out, there was a little feeling within him that said, I finally got him. You know. So that small amount of feeling of satisfaction, right? Why? Because a tzaddik, God judges him even for the most minute flaw, right? So that was the minute flaw. And we see it constantly, this idea that for not doing something 100% right, only 99.5% right, for that 0.5% that was wrong, you're going to get punished. Yosef was punished not for what he did. What he did was 100% permitted. Right? He said to his father that his father should decide who is right, who is wrong. Right? So of course he's obligated to tell his father. If the Torah says that the afal pikein, and even so he was punished, the Torah is telling us that there was a little bit of a flaw in Yosef. There was a little bit of a feeling of satisfaction in finding fault with his brothers. That's why he was punished. So obviously the Torah doesn't mean, the Chazal don't mean that he was punished because he was wrong. He was 100% right. But since Yosef is a tzaddik, he is punished for the slight impurity of his intentions. That's enough of a reason to punish him. That's the meaning of this.
Could it also be a little bit of Lashon Hara?
It's not Lashon Hara. If you say it in order for your father to rectify the flaw, then it's not Lashon Hara. Right? In the action, in your intention, it may be a little bit of Lashon Hara. Right? So this is why he's punished. He's punished for that little bit of Lashon Hara that there is. Right? For instance, let's say you went to a doctor. You went to a dentist and he did a terrible job on you. Right? Somebody asks you, what do you think about this dentist? I'm thinking about going to him. Is it Lashon Hara to say the dentist isn't any good because he botched up the job? Is it Lashon Hara? No. What about if while you are saying it, you feel the satisfaction, now I got him back, right? I made him lose a client, right? That is an impurity in your intention. You still must say it. The saying is not Lashon Hara. Your intention is Lashon Hara. You understand the difference? So, since we are not tzaddikim, so hopefully God won't punish us for it. But Yosef, who is a tzaddik, right? Even when he does the right thing, he's still punished for not doing it in the right way completely. Okay? Now, in Posuk Dalet, Vayiro Echov ki oso, before Posuk Gimel, V'Yisraelo haves Yosef mikol bonov ki ben zekunim hulo, for Yaakov, Yosef was his favorite son. The continuity, according to Rashi, Zekunim, the simple interpretation is what? That he was the child of old age, Zakein. But Chazal say the Zekunim comes from the other meaning of Zakein, which is what? Chacham. Zakein, Mishikana Chokmah. Meaning wisdom. That Yosef was the carrier of Jacob's, of Avram Yitzchak's wisdom. Meaning he was the carrier of the tradition. That's why he gave him Ksones Pasim, He was like, in a way, like the Kohen Gadol among the brothers. How did the brothers see it, this favoritism? Posuk Dalet, Vayir Rechov Keiso Yohav Aviemi Kolechov, Vayisnu, also they hated him. Simple interpretation is, they saw that he was the favorite by the father, therefore they were jealous. No, that's not what it means. What it really means is, they saw history repeating itself. What history? The history of the choice and rejection. There is a repetition of choice and rejection. Avram has a son that seems to be the chosen one, Ishmael. He's rejected, and Yitzhak becomes the chosen one. Yitzhak has a son that seems to be the chosen one, Esau. He's rejected, Yaakov is chosen. Yaakov is going through exactly the same process, right? Interestingly enough, Yitzchak loved Esau, right? And what came out at the end? Esau was the wrong one. History is repeating itself exactly. They said, oh, the process of purification is continuing. Esau, who is the follower of the three linked chain? Yishmael, Esav, Yosef. Yosef is the Esav of our generation. Let's get rid of him. Okay? Meaning, the fact that the father loved him was just seen by the brothers as a repetition of Yitzchak and Esav relationship. Therefore, that even proved to them what they suspected all along. That Yosef is the bad seed. The same way Yishmael was the bad seed, Esau was a bad seed, Yosef is a bad seed. Therefore, the conclusion is natural. Let's take destiny in our own hands. Let's get rid of him. He's a pursuer, he's a rodent. Let's kill him. The decision to kill Yosef was a decision made based on history repeating itself. That's the meaning of this pasuk. And Yosef has a dream and he says it over. What is the theme of the first dream? The sheaves, the bundles of food. The 11 bundles bow down to his bundle. Now, where is the fulfillment of this prophecy? This is a prophecy, obviously. When is it fulfilled? In Mitzrayim, when the brothers come and ask for food, right? Because the whole theme of the first dream is food. What is the theme of the second dream? The sun and the moon and the 11 stars. That has nothing to do with food, that has to do with power. Is that fulfilled? Of course it's fulfilled. Question is, why does Yosef have to tell them over the dream? What for? Why does he do it, the telling over the dream? What does he have to gain? Or does he feel that he has something to gain? What? Where? What do you mean? Yeah. Where is that fulfilled? The sun is fulfilled by what? Yaakov. The moon.
Yeah.
Oh, so Rashi says Bilhah, his stepmother. Yaakov used the moon as a proof that it's not a prophecy but it's a dream. The question was, is it a prophecy or a dream? What is the difference between a prophecy and a dream? If it's a prophecy, it has to be 100% correct. Right?
He didn't really use it as a proof. If you watch, the pasuk says right afterwards, but he was waiting for them to be fulfilled.
Oh, in other words, Yaakov himself suspected that it's a prophecy, and that the moon applies to whom?
Bilhah.
To Bilhah. But what did he say to the brothers? He said, "What? You see that it's all nonsense, because his mother, Rachel, is dead already. So how could she come and bow down to him?"
He wanted it to be Vayeshu, so that's why he said that.
He made it seem as if the brothers are right, but he suspected that Yosef is really right. Okay? Now, Rashi says here, by the second dream, the third Rashi in Pasuk Yud, Hovoi Novoi, Valoi Imcho Kvar Meso, Rochel is not around. You see that your dream is nonsense. Which part of the dream?
Moon.
The moon, right? The sun and the moon will, and the 11 stars will come down and bow down to Yosef. It's impossible. And Rashi says like this, Vehu loy hoyo yoideya sheadvori magin lebilo. What he didn't know, or we must better say, what he made himself not know, or he acted as if he didn't know, Shehadvori magim lebilo, shegodlo shekimo, his stepmother, Bilo. The rabbi seinu lomdu mikan, and the rabbis learn out from here, she'ein chaloim b'loy dvorim b'teilim, that no dream is 100% correct. That's what they say. Meaning, a dream is never 100% correct. Maybe some of the dream can be right, but never 100% right. Now, do you see the contradiction in this?
Yes, we say it's fulfilled.
Because we say it is fulfilled. So how can the Gemara say that from here we see that a dream can never be fulfilled?
That was what Yaakov was telling him. Yaakov was saying, since your mother's not here, and therefore it's only a dream, and therefore you don't have to worry about it. But once we say it's a prophecy, it will be understood.
Exactly. In other words, the point is like this. There are two types of dreams. And we are saying even prescient dreams. In other words, dreams that are going to be fulfilled can be dreams. You can have a dream that will give you an indication of what's going to happen in the future. It's not necessarily a prophecy. It's a premonition that comes through a dream. That kind of a dream can never be fulfilled in its entirety. But there were many prophecies that came in the form of a dream. Those are not dreams. Those are messages through the dream. Okay? Now, we know what Yosef's dream really was. It wasn't a dream. It was a prophecy in the form of a dream. Therefore, as such, it has to be fulfilled in its entirety. Therefore, we must bother with the question, what about the moon? If the moon represented Yosef's mother, Yosef had no mother. So for that, Chazal come up with the answer, because his stepmother was like his mother. But can the rabbis learn out that there are no dreams that are perfect? Yes, because what did Yaakov say? Don't worry about it, it's only a dream. What's the proof that it's only a dream, says Yaakov? Because you see that it's partially wrong, so it can be a prophecy. Which part is partially wrong? The moon part. So how does that prove that it's a dream? Because by the very nature of the dream, a dream can never be 100% right. From here we learn now that there are no dreams that are completely right. Meaning, not from what actually happened. From the words of Jacob, from the Havamini of Yaakov, we learn it out. Okay, we'll stop here. Which means, and he believed that it's going to happen. Mamtinu Metzape means that he's sure that it's going to happen. In other words, Yaakov is convinced that it's a prophecy. The brothers are convinced that it's not a prophecy. Now, when the Rambam, in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, the Rambam says, how do we know that a prophet is reliable? When do we have to listen to a prophet? So the Torah brings up only one sign. Meaning, if a person comes to you and tells you, listen to this and this, if it doesn't contradict what the Torah says, right? And he makes a sign, he tells you doesn't have to be supernatural. It's exactly at 7 o'clock it will start raining. And you look at your watch, and a minute before 7 it doesn't rain. And exactly at 7 o'clock it rains. That's a sign that the prophet is reliable, and you're obligated to listen to the prophet. That's what the Torah says. The Rambam brings down another condition. How do we know that he's a reliable prophet? The Rambam says like this. If there is a man that you know him from before, and according to his actions you judge that he is fit to be a prophet. In other words, he's righteous, he does all the right things. You just don't know that he actually is a prophet, but he is fit to be a prophet. If this man comes to you, and he tells you something which does not contradict the Torah, and he makes this sign, then you rely on him. In other words, he adds the condition that he has to be fit to be a prophet. Which means, a person may come to you and do the most miraculous things. You don't have to listen to him, if you don't think that he's fit to be a prophet.
Even if he's not contradicting the Torah.
Even if he's not contradicting the Torah. Now, there is no full Tanakh. I was looking for Sefer Melachim. Does anybody have a full Tanakh here? Nobody. There is a story in Melachim that clearly indicates this idea of the Rambam. This idea that you have to be fit to be a prophet. There is a story of Eliyahu HaNavi going up to Lebanon, escaping from Israel. He's going up to Lebanon. He comes to a city and he's looking for food. And he comes to a lady and he asks for food. And the lady says, I don't have enough for myself and my son. How can I give you? So Eliyahu HaNavi says the following. Start making those cakes. The oil will never finish until you are finished making the cakes, and the flour will never finish. And she starts. She has only enough for one cake for herself and the son, and she starts baking the cakes, and it never ends. There is more oil, there is more flour. Okay, is that a miracle? Well, what can be a greater miracle than this? The story continues. And after that, the son of the lady became very ill. And she called out Eliyahu HaNavi, and Eliyahu HaNavi comes, and he makes a whole thing, and he prays, and he saves this, and he revives the son. The son was already technically dead. So the lady says like this, now I know that you are a man of God. And everything you say, v'kol dvorecho emes, and everything you say is true. How do we understand this story? I mean, wasn't the miracle of the breads, of the cakes, enough of a miracle? How does the miracle of the breads differ from the miracle of taking care of her son? You see, the miracle of the breads doesn't show any righteousness at all. It's a miracle, that's all it is. He wanted food, so he makes a deal with a lady. You bake cakes, you left plenty in order to feed me. But now that he goes out of his way to save the child of the woman, he has nothing to gain out of it. It's an act of pure tzidkus. Only a tzaddik can do it. Now I know that what you say is true. In other words, a miracle doesn't prove anything. It's when I see that you are righteous men, that's a proof that you're a good prophet. And also, in the pasuk itself...
Only a tzaddik could do it, or only a tzaddik would want to do it?
Only a tzaddik would do such a thing, to go out of his way to save the child, to pray to God. Why should anybody else care? What about in the Pasuk itself, when the Pasuk in Sefer Dvorim talks about how you choose a prophet, how you find out that it's a good prophet, it says like this, Ki yovoi novi mikirbecho, when a novi will come amongst you, and he will make some kind of a sign, you are supposed to listen to him. Why does it have to be amongst you, mikirbecho? Exactly. You know, even though the Torah doesn't say clearly what the Rambam says, that you have to know him, but the fact that the Torah says Mikir Becho is a sign that you have to know him. Otherwise, maybe he's a... Why should he be a stranger? In Dvorim Kisobo. Now, Yaakov Ovinu thinks that Yosef is a tzaddik. What's the proof? He gives him over the tradition of Yitzchok. The brothers think of him as a wicked man. Obviously, how will they take his prophecy? It's no prophecy. It can be a prophecy. If they decided beforehand that he's wicked, what about Yaakov himself? He is convinced Yosef is fit to be a prophet, so then it's a prophecy. That's what it means. In Pasuk Yudalet. Vayikanu bo echov. Remember, the brothers are jealous of him. They are convinced he's a wicked man. So how can he be a prophet? But ve'oviv shomaris adovori. He's convinced it's a good prophecy. Okay? Now, since he is convinced that it's a prophecy, why would God ever tell people what's going to happen? What for? What is the purpose of prophecy? Of predictions? What is the purpose? Just for curiosity's sake that we should know what's going to happen? It's always in order to do something about it, to rectify it. Okay? So Yaakov decided in the following story to make sure that he'll take care of the prophecy. The question is how? How is Yaakov's plan related to the prophecy? What's Yaakov's plan? One day, the sons go to Shechem to take care of the flock. So, Yaakov tells Yosef, your brothers are in Shechem, I'll send you to them. Make sure that everything is in order over there. Shlom is a hint to Shalom. They should live in peace with the brothers. Why did Yaakov send Yosef to the brothers in Shechem? For what purpose?
For the prophecy, this 11 bowing around the one.
Exactly. In order that the prophecy should be fulfilled. That's why he's doing it. Since he believed that the prophecy had to be fulfilled, so let's fulfill it. The sooner the better. Now, what would have been gained if the brothers would have bowed down to Yosef? What would have been gained? This is hinted at the end of Pasuk 14. Vayishlocheyu me'emek Hebron. And Yaakov sent him from the valley of Hebron. Asks Rashi on the spot. Hebron is no valley. What do you mean, Emek Hebron? Says Rashi that the word Emek has another meaning. Emek, besides meaning valley, is also connected with Amok, which means, the word Amok means that you don't see on the surface. But it's related to Hebron, says Rashi. It's related to the man buried in Hebron. Who is that? Avram Avinu. What did Avram Avinu receive a message from God concerning what? The exile in Egypt. Well, he sent them because of that prophecy that we have to go to Egypt. Now, how is that connected? Very simple. It was destined for the Jews to be exiled in Egypt. To be exiled, not in Egypt. To be exiled. That exile is that they have to experience subservience, avdus. Why do Jews have to experience avdus? Because they have to experience the opposite. They have to experience freedom. They have to go through Pesach. Right? You can't have a Pesach. You can't have a freedom. You can't have freedom, or you can't experience freedom. You can't appreciate freedom unless you appreciate it, unless you experience its opposite. Therefore, we had to be in Egypt in order to experience freedom. And who needs freedom? Who needs Pesach? Because Pesach leads to Shavuos. That's why we need Pesach. Here. Without subservience, there is no freedom. Without freedom, there is no acceptance of a yoke. In order to accept the yoke of the Torah, we have to be absolutely free. Only a free person is capable of accepting a yoke, a responsibility. A slave only accepts orders. It doesn't take on a responsibility. You hear the difference? In order for Shavuos to exist, which is the day of the accepting of the Torah, we have to go through Pesach. Only after Pesach can we be ready, after 49 days, to accept the Torah. Therefore, it was destined for Jews to have to go through an experience of subservience. The question is, what shape will that subservience take? The prophecy of Joseph gave an alternative to the brothers to experience subservience by being subservient to Yosef himself. Do you hear this idea? Now, why Yosef? Why nobody else? Why specifically Yosef? So that, Rav Avshalom Rav Hutner used to say that Yosef is the only tribe that is a semi-patriarch. He's not a pure tribe. He's superior to the tribes in his very status. What's the proof? Who are the 12 tribes? Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Dor, Naphtali?
God.
God, Ve'osher?
Yosef,
Ubinyamin?
No.
That's only because you counted Levi. And if you don't count Levi, then it's Ephraim and Menashe. So what's Yosef? A semi-patriarch, right? Rav Hutner, Rav Hashem, used to say that Yosef is half patriarch, half tribe. He's like the link, the in-between. Therefore, if the rest of the tribes accept him, then they can experience the subservience without having to go to Egypt. In other words, if the brothers would have bowed down to Yosef, they would have avoided the problem of Egypt. Okay? So, they come to Shechem. And take a look in Pasuk 15. Vayimtzoehu ish. And a man found him. Vayimtzoehu ish. Now, listen carefully. What does it mean, Vayimtso Ehu Ish? Who finds whom? Is it Yosef finds the Ish, or the Ish finds Yosef? What does it seem in the pasuk?
He found the man.
What?
He found the man.
That's what it should have said, that Yosef found the man, right? I mean, Yosef is going to look for the brothers. He didn't find the brothers, he found the man. And he asked the man, where are the brothers? But that's not what it says in the pasuk. In the pasuk it says what?
The man found him.
What does that imply? The man was looking for him. Who can be a man that's looking for Yosef? Who sends him? Only a malach. Can be anybody else. Meaning, when Rashi says it's a malach, it's not that he's made. It's pshat. It can be anything else. Because if it says by himtzoehu ish, it has to be somebody sent for this purpose. Of course, it's a malach. That's what a malach is all about. Okay? The malach tells him they are not here, they are somewhere else. Now, what significance does it have that the brothers weren't there and they were somewhere else? What significance does it have to the story? Obviously, the Torah tells us the whole thing. They came to Shechem. Shechem, they are not there. They are in Doison. Okay, so he goes to Doison and that's where it happens. So what? I mean, what relevance does it have? And you can't tell me the Torah tells it to us because that's the way it was. The Torah skips many things that the way it was. So the Orach Chaim on the Chumash is a beautiful pshat. He says like this. You know, it says in the Gemara, Sheluchei mitzvah einom nizokim. A sheliach mitzvah, if you go to do a mitzvah, you don't have to worry about anything happening to you. I mean, it's question, does that apply today also when there is hashgoche is not as close as it used to be in those days? Or do you need completing a pure intention in your shlichut, in your agency? That's a different question. But Yosef, for sure, when he fulfilled the mitzvah, it was with his whole heart. Could it possibly be that anything wrong could happen to Yosef if he's fulfilling the mitzvah of Kibud Av? So how did it happen that he comes, he fulfills the mitzvah of his father, and something bad happens to him? Doesn't that contradict the rule of Sheluchei mitzvah einom nizokim?
Because he was only told to go to Shechem.
Oh, says the Orach Chaim, because he was told to go to Shechem. So even though technically he was still following what his father told him by going to Doison, but that's not the shlichus. That was his own decision. On that, the rule of shlichem mitzvah inon nizokin doesn't apply anymore. This is the significance of it. What? We once spoke about it, that whenever a detail is mentioned, which is not absolutely relevant to something, the detail doesn't change. Remember we once spoke about, if I go into a bookstore, and I point to a book, and I say, I would like to buy that Gemara. And then it comes out that it's not a Gemara, it's a Chumash. Is the deal still a deal? No, it's not. It's a Mekach Tos. I wanted to buy a Chumash, not a Gemara. But what about if I say, I want that black Gemara, and I take it home and it's blue? Is that valid?
Depends.
That what? If the color is just secondary to the deal, then it is valid. Because I was just pointing out where it is. I mean, it's not significant whether it's there or not. Okay? Same way, I send a man to marry a woman in a certain city, right? And he finds the woman in the other city. Is the agency still valid? If the fact that she lives in that city is just a way to find her, it's not essential to the woman, then it's valid. So your question is, on the Orach Chaim, Shechem, on the surface, sounds as an insignificant thing. It just happens to be that they were in Shechem. That wasn't essential to the shlichus. That's what you asked. So that's, on the surface, destroys the idea of the Orach Chaim. Except that the Orach Chaim knew that Shechem is essential to Yaakov sending the children there. Why is Shechem essential? You know that there is a rule that whenever we see a certain flaw in a certain personality or in a certain place, there's a certain flaw, like a certain city has a certain flaw. So we know that in the flaw lies its strength too. In other words, if you want to rectify what's wrong with that city, you have to overcome that flaw, and that will be its strength. Right? For instance, if you feel that you have a certain flaw in your personality, by rectifying that flaw, that will be your strength. That itself will be your strength. The flaw of Shechem. What is the flaw of Shechem, of this place called Shechem? There is a historical flaw that repeats itself in Shechem. Rashi says that right here on the spot. Dina happens in Shechem. Rashi says something else happened in Shechem. When does the unity of the Jewish people break up? With Dina also, the father against the sons, the Jews against the Shechemites. What? The kingdom splits. When does the unity of the kingdom split? David, Shlomo, Rehavam, all one kingdom breaks up. Where does a rebellion happen? Shechem. What do we see from that? That Shechem is vulnerable to human relations among Jews. Therefore, where does the rectification have to come from? In the place of the vulnerability, that's where the rectification has to come. So, since they went to Shechem, Yaakov sees it as a sign, oh, there's a perfect place to rectify it. So therefore, Shechem becomes essential to the agency, to the shlichut. Okay? Now, Posuk Yud Ches.
Can you repeat? I'm not clear.
One from far away, Uveterem Yikrav Aleihem, before Yosef came near to them, Vaisnaklu oso lehamiso. The word Vaisnaklu is a very, very difficult word. Vaisnaklu, if you take a look in the Targum Unklus, I don't know, how is it translated in English? I'm interested in the simple interpretation, I don't know. Well, how does it say in Vaisnaklu in the English? Doesn't it? What? They?
Conspired.
Okay, so that's okay. Ramban says that Vaisnaklu oso lamiso means they used some kind of magic in order to kill him from far away.
Ramban.
And it didn't work. Unklus just says Vachashivu aloi lemiktelei. Vachashivu means what? They thought, they planned, that's all. According to the Ramban, they used some kind of supernatural method to kill him, right? But we don't know what kind of method they used. It didn't work. Listen, he's the man of the Chalomos. So what if he's the man of the Chalomos? The Chalomos show that he's Chayev Misa. How does his halomos show that he's chayev mise? That he deserves the death penalty? Okay, alright. That's a novel idea. As false novi. But there is a something that is accepted as a simple fact. There is a law of moreid bemalchus. Anybody who wants to take away the kingdom to the one who rightfully deserves the kingdom is called moreid bemalchus. Do you know that they had a king? According to Chazal, they had a king in those days. In other words, they had already chosen the man who is going to be the dominant force among the tribes. Do you know who it was? Yehuda. We know that. Because then they fire him right after the story of Yosef. They get rid of him. They say, you didn't do your job well, so we'll get rid of you. But at this time, Yehuda is already the chosen king. What does the dreams mean? They all bow down to me. I want to be the dominant force in Klal Yisrael. Therefore, it's a Moreid Bemalchus. Moreid Bemalchus Chayev Mise. So he's telling over the dreams is just a way of telling us that he wants to dominate the rest of Klal Yisrael. That makes him a Moreid Bemalchus. That makes him Chayev Mise. So therefore, we have all the right in the world to kill him. Now, Posucho, Vato Lechu V'Nehargeyu, let's kill him. V'nashlicheyo b'chada boirois. V'omarnu, and what will we say? Chayoro acholosu. Now, that's what we are going to say to whom? To Yaakov. Chayoro acholosu. And what will that do? So on the surface, it will take away the blame from us, right? There's something much more. in this period of Hashgoche Protis, the Golui, right, if a Chayoro, if a wild animal attacks Yosef, it's a sign that he's guilty and not innocent. You hear this? In other words, if he's really as righteous as Yaakov thinks he is, God wouldn't have allowed him for a wild animal to tear him apart. Therefore, that would prove to our father that we are right and he is wrong. Yeah.
Why?
If Yaakov is right and he's really righteous, then he's a Novi Emes, then we have to listen to him. We can't say the truth.
So they weren't sure.
Sure on their own, but how can we pacify the father? His father, that he is wrong and we are right. Why couldn't they say the truth? We killed him. And that would also convince Yaakov that they are right and Yosef is wrong. Because God wouldn't have allowed them to kill Yosef if Yosef is innocent. Says, this is the question of the Amik Dover, the Netzivrim Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. And this is the statement that he makes, quoting the Zohar. Listen to this statement, it's a shocking statement. He says like this, Bechiras ho'odom, free will overcomes destiny.
On the spot, isn't it?
On the spot, right here on the spot. Which means like this. If it's a wild animal, or as we're going to see later on, Reuven's idea, if it's a venomous snake that bites Yosef, that is a proof that Yosef is guilty. But if a human being kills Yosef, that just proves that the human being is a Rosho, that's all. It doesn't prove at all the guilt of Yosef, because then it's the Bechiras Ho'odom overcoming what Yosef deserves. That can happen.
Wait a minute,
and don't misunderstand me to say that God can't overcome man's free will. He can, but it requires a special intervention. You hear what Amik Dover adds? It doesn't mean that God can't overcome man's free will. If God really wants Yosef to stay alive, of course he will stay alive. It's just no proof of his innocence, of his guilt, the fact that he's dead, because it could be just a sign of man's free will. God decided not to intervene, but that doesn't mean that man is guilty. But if God allows the snake to bite him, then it's 100% proof that he's guilty. Remember, we are talking in those days that when tzoras was a sign that something is wrong with your mouth, right? You spoke lashon hara. And if you got any other sickness, it was a sign that something is wrong with your soul. So if an animal attacks you, that means that something is wrong with your soul. Okay? This is what the Amik Dover says here on this spot. Now, in Posuk Chof Aleph, Vayishma Reuven, and Reuven heard, on the surface it's difficult to know exactly what he heard. Vayishma Reuven Vayatzileyu Miyodom, and he decided to save him. So, in many commentaries it's mentioned like this. Did you see the last Posuk Chof? Ve'ato lechu v'nargeyu, the brothers say, let's kill him. V'nashlicheyu b'chad aboyroish. V'omanu chayo roach olosu. And we'll say that a wild animal attacked him. V'nire'e mayihiyu chalomosov. And we'll see what happens to his dreams. Who said that? We'll see what happens to his dreams.
Yaakov.
What do you mean? Rakov is not even here. He's not even part of the scene. Who said it? V'nire'e, let's see what happens to his dreams. V'nire'e, my yuchalomosov. Who's saying that?
Reuven.
No, it wasn't Reuven. It was probably...
It was Shimon and Levi.
What? Let's see what happens to his dreams.
Shimon and
Levi. It sounds like a little sarcasm, right? And this is how Ramban learns. It's sarcasm. Ah, let's see what happens to his dreams, as if to say, we'll see when we kill him. Let's see what happens to his dreams. Lawrence, Baskoil. It was a Baskoil from heaven. A voice from heaven came out and said, you want to kill him? Nirema Yuchalmo. So let's see what happens to his dreams. In other words, a Baskoil came out and said, you won't be able to succeed. You won't succeed. Now, a Baskoil is something that if you are ready to listen, to hear it, you can hear it. If you are not ready to hear it, it can be a very loud Baskoil. You just won't hear it. Vayishma Reuven. is that baskel that says Venirema Yuchal Moshav. Okay? He heard it. Therefore he decided, I gotta save it. But how can I convince my brothers? They didn't hear the baskel. So I'll tell him, listen, why do we have to kill him? Let God kill him. How can we make God kill him? Let's throw him into a pit with venomous snakes, right? And if he's killed by the snakes, that is a proof that he's guilty. Why do we have to really do it? Right? In other words, when we'll tell our father, Chayo Roach Olosu, that he was killed by a wild animal, let it be true. Right? A snake bit him and killed him. And that will be a sign that he's really guilty. What did Reuven really have in mind? That even if he's guilty, he wants to save it. He figured, even if he's guilty, maybe it'll take a few hours for the snakes to bite him. Maybe he will be able to charm them for a while or something like this, yeah? And they throw him into the pit. Then, before Reuven comes back to take him out, they sell him. That's Yehuda's idea. Posuk Chovov. Vayomer Yehuda Echov. Ma betza kinaro gesochinu vechisinu es domoi. So again, the Amek Dovor learns that they were. What's Yehuda's argument? Yehuda's argument is the following. You see. At what point can we say that you are a gromo? The whole point is gromo, that you only indirectly causes death. For instance, let me just give it to you as an example. Let's say you throw down Yosef from a cliff, right? 100 foot high, right? And there are stones on the bottom. You throw him down. Is that a guaranteed death? And if God wants to save him, does he have to intervene in a supernatural way? Or can it happen in a natural way? No, if God saves him, it's a supernatural. Because nobody survives. I'm just giving an example, 100 feet, maybe 1,000 feet, whatever it is. What about if I throw him down from a cliff only 10 feet high? As long as some people survive such a fall, then we have to consider the death indirect. In other words, God intervened. You follow what I'm saying? In other words, at a certain point, it becomes indirect. Because many people survived. He didn't. That's his fault. That means that that you were guilty. Yes? The question is, if you throw in a man to a pit of venomous snakes, isn't that equal to throwing him down from a cliff 100 feet high? At least that's the argument of Yehuda. Which means like this. If after an hour Yosef is still alive, or after a day Yosef is still alive, isn't that miraculous? So if he's dead, it still doesn't prove his guilt. Let's do something that will really prove his guilt. If he's guilty, God will make it happen that he dies. Right? So instead of leaving him in that pit, let's sell him to the Shmuelim. Let's sell him to the Arabs. Right? If he deserves good treatment, he'll get good treatment. And if not, he won't. But if we throw him into the pit, we are not gaining anything. It's still our fault. It's still our free will. He still may be innocent and we are killing him. That's Yehuda's argument. And they accept it. And he sold to the Shmuelim. Reuven comes back to the boar and Yosef is not there. He thinks, in Posuk Lamed, Vayoshev Elecho Vayimar, Hayeled Einenu Vani Ono Ani Bo, I'm the oldest, I'm responsible, how can you do it to me? So there is no answer of the brothers, right? You see, what? Oh, question is, what happened to Reuven during the whole sale? Where did he go? So Rashi says there are two opinions. One, that he went back to take care of his father, because they used to take turns of taking care of the father, right? And two, that, you know, Reuven is the symbol of tshuva. You know that Reuven is the symbol of tshuva? By Klal Yisrael, who is the first Jew to do tshuva for an avera? You know who it is? Reuven. He shows us the way of tshuva, Reuven. So he was so involved in tshuva that he wasn't able to join the brothers in this banquet that they made by the boar. Remember, they sat down and ate bread? He was away doing tshuva. In other words, his tshuva took him away from the rest of the brothers.
How would the first idea work?
Again?
How would the first idea work if he went back to his father? Surely it would take days to get there.
Right, but we don't know how fast everything happened here. Meaning, how long did it take him to decide to throw him into the boar? We have no idea. Not necessarily in one day. I mean, between the decision to throw him into the pit and the carrying it out may have taken a week or two. We have no idea. It doesn't say in the Torah. Meaning, the assumption that it all happened in one day is false, according to this pshat. Now, in Pasuk Lamed Dalet, Vayikra Yaakov Simlo Sov, after they show it to Yaakov, he rents his clothing, Vayosem Sag Bemosnov, the sign of mourning, Vayisabel Al Bno Yomim Rabim. And everybody came to give him consolation, and he did not accept the consolation. Now, why didn't he accept the consolation? The Gemara says that someone who passes away from the family after a year, God sort of helps men to be able to overcome the loss. So why didn't it happen then? Because intuitively, Yaakov knew he was still alive. You can't accept consolation for someone who is still alive. He sensed that he's still alive. Vayev Kosov, even the whole time he used to cry for him. Ve'amedonim mochru osol Mitzrayim. Then the Midianites sold him to Mitzrayim, because according to Rashi, the Ishmaelim sold Yosef to the Midianites. Lepotifar seris paro sarat abochim. To Potifar, the Sar HaTabochim, the head of the butchers of Paro, and he was an Eved, right? So what he wanted his brothers to become, he became, right? He became the Eved of the Sar HaTabochim. Okay, stop here. According to the way we understood it, that the decision to kill Yosef was a decision that wasn't a result of an emotional moment of anger towards Yosef. It was a logical decision based on two things. First, the fact that Yosef, through saying over the dreams, is definitely a usurper of Malchus, like a Mored Bemalchus, the same way that a rebel against the king deserves the death penalty. Yosef is definitely a Mored Bemalchus. Malchus is already something that Yehuda is supposed to get. Second of all, they saw Yosef as a repetition of the story of Esau. There were too many details that they saw. First of all, they believed that the process of purification will go on another generation, third generation. Ishmael, Esau, Yosef. Esau was loved by his father, Yosef is loved by his father, so obviously he deserves to be gotten rid of. When they decide to throw him into the pit, they are saying, really, well, why should we kill him, right? Let the snakes kill him. And if they don't, that will be a proof that we are wrong and he is right. Of course it's impossible. Of course the snakes eventually are going to kill him, because he's not righteous. So when Yehuda says, what do we have to gain, right? By killing him, let's sell him. Obviously, he's planning to say that whatever purpose is we get to by throwing him into the snake pit, we can get by selling him to Egypt. How? In what way? So the fact is that living in Egypt, as far as your spiritual life was concerned, was almost impossible. The culture, the Egyptian culture, was so powerful that no one survives spiritually the Egyptian culture, the Egyptian way of life. So what Yehuda is saying is, what are we trying to do? We are trying to test Yosef's righteousness. So why do we have to test it? By finding out whether the snakes kill him or not, let's do something else. Something much less bloody. Let's see if he survives spiritually. We know for sure he won't. If he's really wicked, the Egyptians will destroy him completely. So that is the best test. That's the meaning of Ma Betza. What do we have to gain? All we want to know is that his wickedness should come out into the open. Nothing better than bringing him to Egypt. Egypt is the best place that all your wickedness come to their full potential. Okay? This is the pshat in Yehuda's decision. Now,
what makes it preferable?
Why is it preferable? Because after all, it's not... You see, we believe that no matter how right you are in killing, right? You know, there is a statement by Rabbi Akiva. You know that the Gemara says that there is a Mishneh in Makos that says like this: Sanhedrin, if a Sanhedrin, what's the job of the Sanhedrin? To pass judgment on people, right? If a Sanhedrin would pass the death penalty more than once in 70 years, 70, it was called the killer court. Right? Omar Rabbi Akiva, so Rabbi Akiva says, and if I would have been in any court in history, no one would have ever died. That's what Rabbi Akiva says. Says Rabban Gamliel, so what good would you be doing? You would have caused more killings, more murders. Because if people don't have the death penalty as a deterrent, if you would have found that a legal loophole to avoid giving the death penalty, you would be causing more murders. That is the argument between Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Akiva. So on the surface, it sounds like this: an argument whether the death penalty is a deterrent or it's not a deterrent. Right? The Rabbi Gamliel holds that the death penalty is a deterrent, and Rabbi Akiva holds that the death penalty is not a deterrent. So why should we have to go through the death penalty? That's not so. Even Rabbi Akiva believes that the death penalty is a deterrent. Because it's logical. Of course, there are some people who won't kill if they know that they are going to get the death penalty. So, of course, it's a deterrent to some people. Rabbi Akiva really believes that no matter how important it is to carry out the death penalty, the damage that it does to us, to the society, that kills, is greater than the advantage of the death penalty being a deterrent. In other words, a society that carries out a death penalty, it corrupts, right? I always say over what Golda Meir once said concerning one thing that will never forgive the Arabs, right? Maybe we'll make peace with them, but we'll never forgive them for making murderers out of our children. It's a tremendous depth in that statement. What it really means is, you may be 100% right in what you are doing, but if you kill, it corrupts you. Even though you have all the reasons in the world, it's self-defense, they started first, they want to throw us, it's all okay, right. But if you kill, it corrupts you. That's pshat in what Yehuda is saying. Of course we have every right in the world to kill Yosef, but it's bad for us, right? Selling him is less damaging to us, because we won't be killing, because killing corrupts the killer, no matter how right he is in doing it. That's pshat in Yehuda. So, once he's sold, the interesting thing is that Chazal say that Yosef, right, you know, for 9 years, he's second in command in Egypt, and he never sends a message to Yaakov, right, that he's alive. Yitzchak, Yaakov's father, take a look what it says over here in Posuk Lamed Hey, in Posuk 35, when it says, Vayevk Oso Oviv. You know how Chazal interpret Vayevk Oso Oviv? And his father cried with him, Oso, in the, like Ito. Whose father cried with whom? say Chazal, Yitzchak cried with Yaakov. What does it mean, Yitzchak cried with Yaakov? Yitzchak is still alive now. Who? No, Yitzchak, just the opposite. Yitzchak is still alive at this point. Yitzchak knows that Yosef is alive, but would not tell Yaakov. Why? Why is it so important that Yaakov shouldn't know? More. When, you know that at the end, when Yosef breaks down and he tells his brothers, right, I'm your brother, right? So the Meshech Chochmah says over here, and Yosef couldn't control himself anymore. Says the Meshech Chochmah, what does it mean he couldn't control himself anymore? What's the implication? That really Yosef logically decided to control himself till when? When would he finally have said, I'm Yosef? What was his plan? Right? When Yaakov comes and he bows down to him, not knowing that he's Yosef, thinking that he is the one that controls Egypt, then I can tell him, I'm Yosef. Why does he want that his father should come, not know that he's Yosef, and bow down? For the fulfillment of the dream. In other words, he sees the second dream as a dream that must be fulfilled for the sake of the Jewish people. Why? Because the more, the better the dream is fulfilled, what is the nature of the dream, of the second dream? Subservience. The Jews have to go through the experience of subservience. The more the subservience will be concentrated in this generation, the less necessary will be for the subservience to occur in the next few generations. In other words, the Egyptian exile will be much easier the more intense is the fulfillment of this dream. So Yosef is doing it for the sake of the future of the Jewish people. In other words, he sees the meaning of the second dream as a way to make it easier for the exile of Egypt of the Jewish people. In other words, the more subservience they will go through, right, the less will be the difficulty of avdus, of servitude in Egypt. Yes? So this is the reason why Yitzchak doesn't tell Yaakov, why Yosef doesn't tell Yaakov, right? It's only, like the Meshech Chochmah says, because Yosef breaks down and he's not capable, because it wasn't humanly possible for him to hold, to control himself. But if it would be, he would have waited until Yaakov bows down to him. Now, in chapter Lamed Ches, Vayhi bo Esahi, Vayered Yehuda meyes echot. Now, literally, the statement means that Yehuda comes down from his brothers. There isn't much of a meaning to that statement, unless we take the second meaning of coming down. Coming down means coming down in the opinion of the brothers. That what? We said that they had decided that the dominant tribe among them is Yehuda. Right? Meaning it's not just that Malchus comes from Yehuda, it's just a coincidence. Somehow it fits the characteristics of Yehuda. Yehuda is by nature the king. That was something that was sensed by the brothers, and this is why they listened to him. The fact is that as soon as they listened to him and he was sold, they regretted it. They changed their minds. And they blamed Yehuda now. They said, if you would have told us not to sell him, we wouldn't have sold it. So therefore, we blame you and we fire you. And Yehuda was fired. So, what? No, because they said, if you see how much we listen to you, if you would have said, let's forget about the whole thing and take him out and bring him back to his father, we would have listened to you too. In other words, they are going through the process of tshuva, the brothers. And who do they blame for everything? Yehuda. So that's what it means. Vayhi bo Esahi. And at this time, caused by the events that we just described, Vayered Yehuda meyesecho. Yehuda was put down by his brothers, and they wanted nothing to do with him. So this is why he breaks away, and he starts his own life separated from his brothers.
If they were that much true, why didn't they go get him and redeem him?
At that time, it was impossible. I imagine it was impossible already. I mean, the facts. Yehuda gets married. He has three sons: Eir, Onon, and Shelah. And many years pass, and Eir gets married to a woman called Tomar. Pasuk Vav. Eir did something wrong, and he dies. And in Pasuk Ches, Vayomer Yehuda leOnon, and Yehuda says to Onon, Bo Elisha Sochicho, now you are supposed to marry your brother's wife. Veyabemoso, you have to be Mekai in the midst of Yibum. Very odd. In the midst of Yibum is a Jewish mitzvah. It's a mitzvah in the Torah. What shall I have to say that the mitzvah of Yibum, obviously it was known already at the time. Vehokeim zera leochicho, and establish descendants to your brother. Right, that's what it says in Parshas Kiseitze, that's the purpose of Yivum, to give children to the brother. And now comes a very odd Pasuk 9, Vayeda Onon kiloi loyeazora, and Onon figured, if so, the child will belong to my brother. So why should I have a child for my brother? So therefore he decided not to have any children at all. So, so that's why he made sure that the seed will never go into Tomar. She never got pregnant. So he was also punished, and he also dies. Now, that custom of marrying the brother of the dead person was such a strong custom. Obviously, it's not a law, because it's not one of the Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach. But it was such a minhag, such a strong minhag, that she was considered osur to marry anyone else in the meantime. Now she has to wait for the third brother, Shelah. What is the halach in the meantime? So, according to Torah, she's called Shoyim Meretz Yovam, right? She's osur to marry anybody else. But it's obvious that even in those days, even before the Torah was given, it was an accepted law. Listen to what Yehuda tells her, right? Yehuda lesomer kalosei. Shevi almono beis avich. You have nothing to do now. You can't get married. You must go back to your father's house and stay there. A widow. In other words, don't marry anybody. Adigdal shelobni. Until shelob... Adigdal shelobni. Until shelob grows up. But really, what did Yehuda plan to do? Never to allow Shelah to marry her. Why? Because he doesn't know that Eir and Onon died because of their own sins. He thinks, right? First one dies because he married her, Tomar. Second one dies because he married Tomar. There is something about Tomar that kills husbands. Therefore, why should he take a chance and allow her, his third son, to marry? So he has in mind not to allow Shelah to get married to her. Okay? Now, in Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayirbu Hayomim, after many years, Vatomos Bashua Eshes Yehuda. Bashua dies. Now, what is the importance of the fact that she dies? Because obviously Yehuda, after she dies, is looking for another wife. Yes? Vainochem Yehuda, and after the period of consolation, a certain period of time that he didn't marry anyone else, right? But now he's ready to marry someone else. Meanwhile, he goes with his friend, Chiro, that's the friend that's mentioned in Pasuk Aleph. And Tomar finds out that he's coming to Timnah, to the city, and she decides to trick him. Now, how? By making herself up like a prostitute, right? And in Pasuk 15, Vayireo Yehuda. Now, why did she do it, the Pasuk says? Because she realized that Shelah is not going to be given to her. So she's going to trick Yehuda to live with her. Now, was that allowed to? According to the Torah law, it's a chiyuv mis, it's one of the arayos. So? To marry her father-in-law is one of the arayas. It's osur. You're not allowed to. Mm-hmm. Says the Ramban, that after Matan Torah, when Arayos, the Isurim, the sexual prohibitions were established, one of the sexual prohibitions is the sister-in-law. Let's say a man has children and he dies. Can his brother marry his wife? It's one of the Arayos, a Chiyuv Miseh. It's only when the woman has no children that the Torah like gives an allowance for the Yibum to happen, right? Now, is the reason for Yibum is so important that the Torah gives an allowance even at the cost of marrying his sister-in-law, right? So he says like this, but before Matan Torah, that the Isurim weren't established, the prohibitions weren't established, any member of the family is good enough in order to fulfill the idea of Yibum. Do you hear clearly? In other words, after the Torah is given, the Torah only leaves one opening for the law of Yibum. Only the brother. The other relatives, not.
What if there are no brothers?
If there are no brothers, the Torah says, let's forget about Yibum. What? Wait, just the opposite. What about before Matan Torah? Any relative is good enough. Right? So it can be, if it's not the brother, it can be the father. It's also close enough. The Torah doesn't allow it, but here we're talking before the Torah is given. So the purpose of Yibum, whatever that purpose is fulfilled if Yehuda marries her also. It doesn't have to be the brother, only after Matan Torah. Now, you're asking a good question, what about Boaz? Boaz is a proof, the Ramban himself mentions it, to his point of view. What's Boaz to Ruth? A far relative, right? We are talking about a nephew's, right, ex-wife. Now, she's allowed to marry Boaz anyway. So therefore, there is nothing to break through. You know, there is no prohibition there. So you can fulfill the idea of Yibum, right? The idea of Yibum is fulfilled even with Boaz. Because that proves the Ramban's point, that it's not only the brother that can do it. Anybody can do it. Except that everybody else of the close relatives, the Torah doesn't allow you to do it, but the purpose would have been fulfilled. You understand? That proves the point of Ramban, that it's all not only by the brother. So,
there would have to be a family member, though, still, to be the idea?
Of course. Or it has to be a family member. It's related.